Hello, everyone, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles published by the Geographic Society in April of 2026. I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with this article, "A Once Banned Mexican-American Tradition is Making a Comeback." Low riding had been outlawed across the U.S. Now it's making a comeback, and nowhere more fashionably than in Albuquerque, thanks to a passionate group of locals. It's by Zoe Gatto. The 1961 Chevrolet Impala leaps skyward with a bounce, chrome flashing in the New Mexico sun. At the wheel, Angelica Griego presses a switch on the dash and again sends the car bunny hopping, leaping a couple of feet clear off the ground. Her window is down, 2-inch hot pink nails resting casually on the door frame, strands of cherry reed tinsel glinting in her hair. In the back seat, I grip the plush leather and do my best to look unfazed. "Nice car," hollers a man from across the street, followed by a long, appreciative whistle. Behind oversized sunglasses, Angelica remains cool as a cucumber, the honeyed tones of 1960s crooner Brenton Wood drifting through her speakers. "We've been cruising through the heart of Albuquerque along Central Avenue, home to the largest urban stretch of Route 66. For barely 10 minutes, and already he's the third such vocal admirer. Others snap photos, eager to capture a fleeting glimpse of pure Americana rolling past. I've come to the state's largest city to delve into the world of low riding, a tradition of driving low-slung cars, often intricately customized and lavished in symbolism. That's part of a Mexican-American culture. It first emerged in the 1940s in the Southwest, among communities who faced social marginalization, and drew on the bright colors and intricate designs of traditional Mexican aesthetics. In New Mexico, where nearly half the population identifies as of Mexican descent, the highest percentage of Hispanic residents in the U.S., it became as much a state symbol as green chili. But from around the post-war period, low-riding spent decades under heavy regulation, dismissed as a public nuisance and associated with gang activity. This was particularly true in the Southwest and along the Pacific Coast, where ordinances banning cruises, where souped-up cars roll leisurely in caravan formation, were common. In Albuquerque, they were banned until 2018. In more recent years, with restrictions lifting, perceptions have changed, and with the centenary of Route 66 coming up, the revival of this motor tradition seems perfectly timed. Today, the city's Sunday evening cruise through downtown draws a lively mix of locals and tourists. The Albuquerque Lowrider Super Show, a showcase of spectacular cars held each June at the city's convention center, is a major event, attracting 15,000 attendees. There's even talk of the Lowrider becoming New Mexico's official state vehicle. This year, events planned for Route 66's centennial include the Route 66 Summerfest, a gathering of local bands, food trucks, and modified classic cars, planned for July along Central Avenue. The sun-bleached corridor saw a boom in Atomic Age motels and restaurants after the Mother Road was realigned in 1937, to pass directly through the high desert city. Much of that mid-century architecture remains, Angelica points out as we glide through her hometown. One moment we're passing the zigzagging facade of the Kemo Theater, its Art Deco details mixed with indigenous Pueblo motifs. The next we're soaking in the flicker of the vintage sign outside the 1959 Imperial Motel. Think of classic Route 66, and chances are it looks like this car-crazed city, providing the perfect backdrop for riding in Angelica's mint-condition convertible. You get a lot of attention as a woman in a car like this, she calls over her shoulder as the craggy outline of the Sandia Mountains begins to fill the windscreen, rising steadily to the east of the city. She tells me she got her first set of wheels at age 15, having grown up in a family of car enthusiasts with her head under the bonnet. When I first came into the scene, it was all very masculine, and I was one of about three girls. Now loads of women are getting interested in lowriding. Even as lowriding becomes more inclusive, Angelica remains one of the few women on the competitive circuit. Since buying her Chevy 4 years ago, she's transformed it into a gliding showpiece with a chrome undercarriage, custom interiors, and hand-painted murals that map key moments in her life. Her creativity has earned her a spot across the country's car shows, where owners put their tricked-out rides on display. Lowriding has always been a spectacle, but here in Albuquerque, women like Angelica are steering it to stylish new heights. I've also added hydraulics to make the car jump up and down and side to side, she says. Moments later, the Impala shimmies back into dance mode, and we bounce past Central Avenue's chorus line of diners, drive-ins, and dives, a stretch of road built for showing off. Creative drive. Behind every lowrider's gleaming ride lie hours of painstaking artistry, and in Albuquerque none have shaped this visual language more than Rob Vanderslice. The following morning, I head to the red brick suburban home of the man who's carved a niche as the Pablo Picasso of the lowriding world. His garage at the back of the house does feel more like a painter's studio than a workshop, only here the canvas comes on four wheels. The walls are lined with a rainbow of spray paints and pots of metal flake, twinkling under fluorescent lights. Showing me around, Rob is quick to explain that his fate was sealed early on, having been raised by a hot rod-obsessed father. My first word wasn't Mom or Dada, it was car, he says with a laugh. Dressed in the unofficial lowrider uniform of a baggy t-shirt, paint-splattered Dickies, cargo trousers, and a long beard, neatly bound with elastic bands, he looks every inch the elder statesman of his community. Over his 40-year career, Rob has watched lowriding shift gears, emerging from the underground into the mainstream. A turning point, he says, came in 2015 with a landmark exhibition of juiced-up vehicles and photos of hoppers, hot rods, and lowrider cars at Santa Fe's New Mexico History Museum, which began to peel away the long-held stigma surrounding the movement. Rob's own creations have since found their way into major institutions, including the Peterson Automotive Museum in Los Angeles. These days, he's working on large-scale installations for the centenary of Route 66, including a trippy, gravity-defying display of lowrider cars suspended from the ceiling of Albuquerque's airport. In demand for his maximalist spray paint style, known as a Rob job, the artist is giving me a taste of the weekend workshops he now occasionally leads, passing on his airbrushing techniques to a new generation. He's been running them since 2019, and says he has noticed an uptick in interest post-pandemic. He demonstrates the process on a skateboard deck, swirling his spray gun with the control of a surgeon wielding a scalpel. I hold my breath as I try to mirror the motion. There's an instant satisfaction to the whole thing, psychedelic shapes blooming from the nozzle in brilliant gradients of color. Practice enough and you might hope to one day achieve something like Rob's More is More masterpiece, a modified 1996 Cadillac Fleetwood parked on his driveway. He's been working on it for the past 18 years. The seats are cloaked in touch-me crushed velvet, the bodywork licked with blazing flames of red and magenta, and LED lights hidden in the exterior paintwork mean the car can light up like a Christmas tree after dark. You might assume this outrageous head-turner is reserved for special occasions, but it's Rob's daily drive, used for the grocery run. This car is like the inside of my mind, colorful, shocking, and loud, he says. My work is all about self-expression. If people think it's too much, I must be doing something right. Along for the ride. The air is thick with petrol fumes and the sweet smell of churros frying at the roadside in Burales. Outside the car window, families line the pavement, grandparents unfolding deck chairs, toddlers perched on shoulders, wide-eyed children craning for a better view as a stream of glinting cars parades by at a snail's pace. Lowriding is trending right now, says Jessica Roybal at the wheel, wearing a strappy sundress, and statement, silver hoop earrings, nodding as we pass a spectator in billowing zoot trousers, braces, and a fedora. This bumper-to-bumper procession is held every few months in Albuquerque's oldest neighborhood, a mostly Hispanic inner-city enclave attracting between 300 and 500 people. An elevated muscle truck rolls past on cartoonishly large wheels, followed by a mint-condition Pontiac Bonneville, its fins and fenders bedazzled in crystals. Jessica's sleek 1980 Pontiac Grand Prix, with a V8 engine purring under the bonnet, fits right in. A trained architect, she first joined the low-riding scene by photographing drivers, but soon caught the bug herself. But despite the growing international attention, low-riding is huge in Japan, where enthusiasts dress in imitation of the Cholo subculture. The practice in this city remains firmly rooted in its origins, Jessica tells me. It's working-class pride, she says, tapping the steering wheel. Ahead, a vehicle lifts and tilts on its suspension, like a ballerina teetering on point. You work all week, then on your day off, you tinker with your car and show what you built. As the cruise winds down, we roll back through the city. We're fortunate to have Route 66, and there's definitely a connection between the streetscape and the cars, says Jessica. When you're cruising in a convertible at night and pass a vintage sign all lit up, it makes you stop in your tracks and just appreciate the beauty of the moment. And that completes the first article. The title was A Once Banned Mexican-American Tradition is Making a Comeback by Zoe Gatto. The next article is titled Space Weather Can Be Deadly. Here's how NASA protects the Artemis II crew. Solar storm tech on Artemis II will help protect humans traveling even deeper into space. It's by Adam Mann. In October 1989, a blast from the sun flung out a stream of super-powered protons. This solar storm lasted for days and forced astronauts working in low Earth orbit aboard NASA's Atlantis space shuttle to retreat to a shielded storm shelter in the farthest interior of the craft. Even while hunkered down, some of the crew reported seeing flashes of light as high-energy particles struck their retinas. It remains one of the biggest solar proton floods ever observed. A NASA researcher later estimated that, if the astronauts had been outside of our planet's protective magnetic field, instead of in low orbit, they would have had a 10% chance of dying during the solar storm. Such storms and other hazardous radiation threats fall under a broader umbrella called space weather. Over the last week, NASA's Artemis II crew has ventured far beyond the safety of our planet's magnetic field, where solar storms pose even more serious threats, even as the threat of space weather remains. But researchers have learned some tricks about how to handle these dangers since the 1989 storm. The Artemis II cruise vessel, Orion, is the first vehicle designed explicitly to deal with risks like high-energy proton flurries. The uncrewed Artemis 1 mission, which flew around the moon in 2022, carried sensors that measured radiation levels all over the craft, providing potentially life-saving information during its sojourn through space. Orion was designed with both a dedicated storm shelter and special shielding to absorb radiation, and sensors on board the spacecraft are measuring radiation levels throughout the mission. "We gained a lot of confidence in our models and systems," says Stuart George, a physicist at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, who helps to measure and mitigate space weather effects. "It's a really good vehicle from a radiation point of view." What are the dangers from space weather? The Orion spacecraft is facing three types of space radiation as it travels from the Earth to the Moon and back. Such radiation acts as subatomic shrapnel, shredding human tissue and DNA, and leaving behind ions that can cause molecular chaos inside the body. Even before they left the part of space dominated by Earth's magnetic field, the Artemis II crew passed through the Van Allen belts, two donut-shaped regions extending between 600 to 60,000 kilometers above the planet. That's higher than the International Space Station flies. These belts are filled with fast-moving protons and electrons trapped by the Earth's magnetic field. While such particles can be harmful, as those encountered during the big solar storm, Orion zipped through the belts in less than an hour, limiting the crew's exposure. The second hazard comes from galactic cosmic rays, atomic nuclei, protons, and electrons jetting through space at significant fractions of light speed. Thought to be expelled by distant exploding stars, cosmic rays are especially dangerous because shielding against them only makes things worse. As these ultra-fast thermonuclear bullets slam into the body of a spacecraft, they cause tiny explosions and unleash a cascade of additional energetic particles, each of which can damage human tissue. The only way to mitigate against such radiation is to travel during periods of high solar activity, since the stream of charged particles surging off the sun creates a protective bubble, much as the Earth's magnetic field shields against solar threats. Artemis II is flying a short time after the most recent peak in the sun's 11-year cycle in late 2024. But this also introduces the final form of space radiation, energetic particle events, flares and mass ejections from the sun. These become far more likely during solar maximum. Yet because of the danger from unstoppable galactic cosmic rays, it's still safer to travel at such periods than when the sun is quieter. How do we detect solar storms? NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, operate several satellites that monitor the sun, looking out for large events like the powerful flare that blasted out just before Artemis II launched. One of the main workhorses is the Deep Space Climate Observatory, situated about 1.6 million kilometers sunward. DSCOVR records solar activity and provides between 15 and 60 minutes of advance warning before a particle storm hits the Earth. And in September 2025, the agencies launched three new satellites to monitor different types of solar activity. The Interstellar Mapping and Acceleration Probe, IMAP, Carruthers Geo-Corona Observatory, and Solar One. Each reached their final position near DSCOVR in January, and Solar One in particular is poised to provide 24/7 observations of powerful solar eruptions called coronal mass ejections. Data from all these observatories is fed into sophisticated forecasting software that tries to determine when inclement space weather is imminent. Researchers focus on active regions of the sun, areas full of complex magnetic twists that tend to contain sunspots and are prone to launching streams of particles. It's very similar to a paper airplane with a rubber band, says Patricia Reif, a space physicist at Rice University in Texas. The more you wind that rubber band, the more kinks you have, and the more energy you put in. Let go of the band and it will violently unravel, launching the paper airplane. Likewise, the kinks in the sun's magnetic field lines get so twisted that they can bend no further, forcefully snapping apart and propelling charged particles and radiation into space. Much like extreme weather events here on Earth, such outbursts happen randomly. Scientists might be able to infer when energy is building up in active regions on the sun based on sunspots and other data, raising the probability that a storm could be unleashed, but there's no way to perfectly predict when a burst will occur. What do astronauts do in case of a space weather event? Last year, officials from NASA, NOAA, and space industry experts gathered in Boulder, Colorado, to simulate how to forecast space weather using the latest models and respond to a potential emergency during Artemis II. Participants monitored fake events based on past data, relayed vital information to one another, and figured out what guidance to give astronauts beyond Earth's magnetic field. The event was eye-opening and extremely useful, says Sean Dahl, a forecaster at NOAA's Space Weather Prediction Center in Colorado. If a solar storm were to happen during a deep space mission, these early warning systems would be critical. Thanks to advanced satellite warning, officials have at least a short window for figuring out how a storm's danger level. If forecasts suggest the astronauts may be in peril, they will be ordered to move to Orion's storm shelter. This is a tiny area at the base of the spacecraft where each astronaut has essentially a small locker that they can stuff themselves into. They will place additional padding and material over their heads to hunker down. Yet a solar tempest can last many days, and the mission designers didn't want to trap the Artemis II astronauts in a cramped space forever. So the spacecraft's wall contains aluminum and high-density polyethylene to absorb some radiation. The crew can also build a special emergency shelter using storage and waste bags, basically anything they can get their hands on, and place against the interior walls of the ship. A colleague described it as an innovative use of available materials, says George. The DIY shelter has also been likened to a pillow fort. As more humans journey to the moon, and perhaps one day Mars, efforts to predict and react to space weather will be vital, and Artemis II's data and tech are just the first step. And that completes the article. The title was Space Weather Can Be Deadly. Here's how NASA protects the Artemis II crew. It was written by Adam Mann. And with that, we have run out of time for today's broadcast. You've been listening to the National Geographic Society program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader today. I hope you enjoyed the program, and I hope you found it informative. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona on a 24/7 basis. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.